white man who wore a pathetic suit with an especially pathetic vest that popped out in front of his belly. "What can I tell you, Donald?" Killian was saying. "The law's like anything else. You get what you pay for, all right?" The little man trudged off without even looking at him. Not once had he been in Killian's presence when the main topic of conversation had not been money, the money due Thomas Killian.
"Hey!" said Killian, smiling at Sherman. "I didn't mean for you to have to wait."
He cast his eyes significantly at the retreating figure of the little man, then shrugged his eyebrows. As he and Sherman walked down the hallway beneath the blazing downlighters to Killian's office, he said,
"Now that,"
his head nodded back in the general direction of the little man,
"is a guy with problems. A 57-year-old assistant principal, Irish Catholic, wife and family, and he gets picked up on a charge of propositioning a 7-year-old girl. The arresting officer claims he offered her a banana and went on from there."
Sherman said nothing. Did this insensitive, wise guy fop, with his incessant cynicism, actually think that would make him feel better? A chill went through him. It was as if the pudgy little man's fate were his own.
"You check out the two guys across from you?"
Sherman braced. Which hell were they trapped in?
28, 29 years old, both of them. And they'd be on the Forbes 400 list if their business published annual reports. They got that much money. They're Cubans, but they import from Colombia. They're Mike Bellavita's clients."
Sherman's resentment grew with each wise guy word. Did the fop really think his breezy survey of the local scene, his detachment, his hard-boiled tone would flatter him, would make him feel superior to the detritus caught in the filthy tide that flows through here? "I'm not superior, you oh-so-knowing, oh-so-ignorant fool. I'm one of them. My heart goes out to them. An old Irish child molester, two young Cuban drug dealers with their sad, pompous hair. In short, he was learning for himself the truth of the saying, a liberal is a conservative who has been arrested." In Killian's office, Sherman took a seat and watched the Irish fop rear back in his desk chair and roll his shoulders about under his double-breasted suit, preening. He resented him even more profoundly. Killian was in excellent spirits. Newspapers were stacked up on his desk. Team Mercedes, he hit, she ran. But of course, the hottest criminal case in New York was his. Well, he was about to lose it. How should he tell him? He wanted to just let him have it. But the words came out with some semblance of tact.
"I hope you realize," said Sherman, "I'm very unhappy about what happened yesterday."
"Aye, who wouldn't be? It was outrageous, even for Weiss."
"I don't think you understand. I'm not talking about what I was subjected to per se. I'm talking about the fact that you..."
He was interrupted by the voice of the receptionist coming over the intercom on Killian's desk.
"Neil Flanagan of the Daily News on 3-0.
Killian leaned forward in his chair.
"Tell him I'll call him back. Now, wait a minute. Tell him I'll call him back in 30 minutes. If he's out of the office, then he should call me back in 30 minutes.
To Sherman. "Sorry." Sherman paused, looked balefully at the fop, and said,
"I'm talking about something else. I'm talking about..."
Killian broke in.
"I don't mean that we're only going to be talking for 30 minutes. The whole day is yours if you want it, and we need it. But I want to talk to this guy Flanagan from the news. He's going to be our antidote to the venom."
"Well, that's fine," said Sherman as flatly as possible. "But we've got a problem. You assured me you had your special contacts in the Bronx District Attorney's office. You told me you had a contract with this man Fitzgibbon. I seem to recall quite a dissertation on something called the Favor Bank. Now, don't misinterpret what I'm saying. For all I know, you may have as keen a legal mind..."
The voice on the intercom.
"Peter Fallow of the City Light on 3-0.
"Get his number. Tell him I'll call him back."
To Sherman.
"Speak of venom. The head snake checks in."
Sherman's heart shuddered in palpitation, then recovered.
"Go ahead. You were saying?"
I'm not doubting your legal judgment, but you made these assurances to me, and naively I went ahead and—" He paused to choose the correct word. Killian jumped in.
"You were double-crossed, Sherman. I was double-crossed. Bernie Fitzgibbon was double-crossed. What Weiss did was unconscionable. You do not do what he did. You do not do it.
Nevertheless, he did it. And after you told me—"
"I know what it was like. It was like being thrown in a cesspool. But Bernie was not totally unsuccessful. Weiss wanted to do worse. You gotta understand that. The son of a bitch wanted to arrest you in your home. He wanted a Park Avenue arrest. He's crazy, crazy, crazy. And you know what he would have done if he had his way? He would have had the cops put handcuffs on you in your own home, then take you to a precinct house and let you get a whiff of the pens there for a while, and then they put you in a van with wire mesh over the windows with a bunch of these animals, and then take you to central booking and let you go through what you went through. That's what he wanted."
"Nevertheless, Mr. Killian, Irv Stone of Channel 1 on 3-2, this is the third time he's called."
"Get his number and tell him I'll call him back," to Sherman. "Today I gotta talk to these people even though I got nothing to tell them. Just to keep the lines open. Tomorrow, we start to turn things around."
"Turn things around," said Sherman, in what was meant as bitter irony. The fop didn't notice. The fop's excitement over such attention from the press was written all over his face. Out of my ignominy, his own cheap glory. So he tried it again.
"Turn things around, all right," he said. Killian smiled.
"Mr. McCoy, I do believe you doubt me. Well, I got news for you. In fact, I got a lot of news for you." He pressed the intercom button. "Hey, Nina, ask Quigley to come in here. Tell him Mr. McCoy is here." To Sherman. "Egg Quigley is our investigator, the guy I told you about, the guy who used to be in major cases."
A tall, bald man appeared in the doorway. It was the same man Sherman had seen in the blazing reception room on his first visit. He carried a revolver in a holster high on his left hip. He wore a white shirt but no tie. His sleeves were rolled up, revealing a pair of huge wrists and hands. His left hand held a manila envelope. He was the sort of tall, angular, raw-boned man who looks more powerful and menacing at 50 than he did at 25. His shoulders were wide but had a degenerate slouch. His eyes seemed to have sunk deep into the occipital craters.
"Ed," said Killian, "this is Mr. McCoy."
Sherman nodded morosely.
"Pleased to meet you," said the man.
He gave Sherman the same dead smile he had given him the first time. Killian said,
"You got the picture?"
Quigley took a piece of paper out of the envelope and handed it to Killian, and Killian handed it to Sherman.
"This is a Xerox, but it took... I'm not even going to tell you what it took to get this picture. You recognize him?"
A profile and a head-on picture of a black man with numbers, square features, a powerful neck. Sherman sighed.
"It looks like him. The other boy, the big one. The one who said Yo needs some help."
"He's a lowlife named Roland Auburn. Lives in the Poe Projects. Right now he's on Rikers Island awaiting disposition of his fourth drug indictment. Obviously he's cutting a deal with the DA in return for testimony against you."
"And lying?"
"That does not in any way violate the principles that have governed Mr. Roland Auburn's life thus far," said Killian.
"How did you find this out?"
Killian smiled and gestured toward Quigley.
"Ed has many friends among our men in blue, and many of our finest owe him favors."
Quigley merely pursed his lips slightly. Sherman said,
"Has he ever been arrested for robbery, or the sort of thing he tried to pull on me?"
"You mean highway robbery?"
Killian chuckled at what he had just said.
"I never thought of that before. That's what it is, highway robbery. Right, Ed?" "I guess so."
"Not that we know of," said Killian. "But we intend to find out a whole lot more about this son of a bitch. Prison inmates are notorious for what they'll testify to, and this is Weiss's whole fucking case. This is what he brought you in on."
Killian shook his head with apparent disgust and kept shaking it. Sherman found himself genuinely grateful. It was the first hint of heartfelt absolution anyone had offered.
All right, so that's one thing, said Killian. Then to Ed, now tell him about Mrs. Ruskin.
Sherman looked up at Quigley, and Quigley said,
she's gone to Italy. I traced her as far as a house she rented on Lake Como. It's some kind of resort in Lombardy.
That's right, said Sherman. She'd just come back from there the night all this happened.
Yeah, well, a couple of days ago, said Quigley. She left there in a car with some young guy named Filippo. That's all I know, Filippo. You got any idea who that might be? Early or mid-20s, slender, medium height, lot of hair, punk clothes, nice-looking kid, or so my man told me.
Sherman sighed. It's some artist she knows. Filippo Chiarazza or Chirizzi.
You know of any other place in Italy she might go to?
Sherman shook his head. How did you find out all this? Quigley looked at Killian, and Killian said, tell him.
Wasn't too odd, said Quigley.
Proud to be on stage, he couldn't resist a smile.
Most of these people have Globe Express, you know, the credit card. There's a woman, a person I deal with in the accounting office on Duane Street. They got a computer network feeds in from all over the world. I give her $100 per item. Not too bad for 5 minutes' work. Sure enough, this Maria Ruskin has two charges 3 days ago in stores in this town Como. Clothing stores. So I call up a guy we use in Rome, and he calls up one of the stores and says he's from Globe Express and gives them her account number and says they need to send her a telegram for account clarification. They don't give a shit. They give him the address where they deliver the merchandise, and he goes down to Como and checks it all. Quigley shrugged as if to say, piece of cake for a guy like me.
Noting that Sherman was properly impressed, Killian said, so now we got a line on both our players. We know who their witness is, and we'll find your friend Mrs. Ruskin, and we'll get her back here, even if Ed has to bring her back in a box with air holes in it. Don't look shocked. I know you give her the benefit of the doubt, but by objective standards, she does not exactly qualify as your friend.
You're in the biggest jam of your life, and she's your way out. And she's off in Italy with a nice-looking fellow named Filippo. Hey, what do you?
Sherman smiled in spite of himself. His vanity was such, however, that he immediately assumed that there was an innocuous explanation. After Quigley had left, Killian said, Ed Quigley is the best. There is no better private investigator in the business. He will do anything. He's your basic hardcore New York Hell's Kitchen Irishman. The kids Ed ran with all became hoodlums or cops. The ones that became cops were the ones that the church got a hook into, the ones that cooked a little bit from guilt. But they all liked the same things. They all liked to butt heads and loosen people's teeth. The only difference is, if you are a cop, you can do it legally with a priest nodding over you and looking the other way at the same time. Ed was a hell of a cop. He was a fucking reign of terror.
How did he get this picture?
Sherman was looking at the Xeroxed page. Was that one of your contracts?
A thing like this? Ooh, forget about it. Getting this information with a mugshot? This is so far out of bounds. I mean, this goes beyond the Favor Bank. I don't ask, but unless I miss my guess, this is the Favor Bank plus the real bank, like your basic negotiable assets. Forget about it. I mean, for God's sake, don't mention it. Don't even think about it again.
Sherman sat back in his chair and looked at Killian. He had come in here to fire him, and now he wasn't so sure. As if reading his mind, Killian said, let me explain something to you. It's not that Abe Weiss doesn't care about justice.
Doesn't?
He had used the correct third-person singular. What exalted notion, wondered Sherman, had wandered into his head.
He probably does. But this case has nothing to do with justice. This is a war. This is Abe Weiss running for re-election, and that job is his fucking life. And when the press gets as hot for a case as they are about this one, he don't know from justice. He's gonna do any goddamn thing he has to do. I don't mean to frighten you, but that's what's going on, a war. I can't just construct a defense for you, I gotta wage a campaign. I don't think he'd put a tap on your telephone, but he has that power, and he's perfectly capable of doing it. So if I were you, I wouldn't say anything of substance about this case over the telephone. In fact, don't say anything at all about it on the telephone. That way you don't have to worry about what's important and what isn't.
Sherman nodded to show he understood. Now I'm going to be very direct with you, Sherman. This thing is going to cost a lot of money. You know what Quigley's man in Lombardy costs? $2,000 a week. And that's just one phase of what we got to do. I'm going to ask you for a big retainer right up front. This is exclusive of trial work, which I still hope will not be necessary.
How much?
$75,000.
$75,000?
Sherman, what can I tell you? The law is like anything else, all right? You get what you pay for.
But good Lord, $75,000?
You force me to be immodest. We are the best, and I'll fight for you. I love a fight. I'm as Irish as Quigley.
So Sherman, he who came to fire his lawyer, wrote out a check for $75,000.
He handed it to Killian.
You'll have to give me some time to get that much money into my account.
That's fair enough. What's today, Wednesday? I won't deposit this until Friday morning.
The menu had little black and white ads across the bottom, little rectangles with old-fashioned borders and highly stylized logos for things like Knee-High Chocolate Drink and Captain Henry's Canned Herring Roe and Café du Monde Dark Roast Coffee with Chicory and Indian Chief Balloon Tire Bicycles and Edgeworth Pipe Tobacco and 666 Cold and Cough Medicine. The ads were sheer decoration, mementos of the old two-lane hardtop days in Louisiana Bayou country. A sixth sense made Kramer flinch. This faux down-home shit was as expensive as the faux bohemian casual shit. He didn't even want to think what this was all going to come to, maybe 50 goddamn dollars. But there was no turning back now, was there? Shelley was sitting right across from him in the booth, watching his every gesture and expression, and he had spent the past hour and a half projecting the image of a man who takes charge and is in control, and it was he, the manly bon vivant, who had suggested that they proceed forthwith to dessert and coffee. Besides, he felt an acute need for ice cream. His mouth and his gullet were on fire. The Café Alexandria didn't seem to have a single item on any course that wasn't a conflagration. The Creole gumbo with bayou sand. He thought the word sand must be a metaphor for some gritty condiment, some ground-up root or something, but there was actual sand in the goddamn soup, apparently drenched in Tabasco. The cornbread cayenne. It was like bread with fire ants in it. The catfish fillet with scorched okra on a bed of yellow rice with apple butter and Chinese mustard sauce. The Chinese mustard raised a red flag, but he had to order the catfish because it was the only semi-inexpensive entree on the menu, $10.50. And Andriuti had said it was an inexpensive little Creole restaurant on Beach Street, really terrific. Beach Street was a crummy enough street to have a cheap restaurant, and so he had believed him. But Shelley kept saying how wonderful it was. She was glowing, a divine radiance with brown lipstick. Although he wasn't entirely sure whether it was love, autumn in the Berkshire's makeup, or a fire in the belly he was looking at. Ice cream, ice cream, ice cream. He scanned the swamp fire prose of the menu, and through the caloric waves he spotted a single ice cream dish. Hand-churned vanilla ice cream topped with walnut chili chutney. Chili? Well, he would scrape the topping to one side and stick to the ice cream. He didn't have the nerve to ask the trendy waitress with all the honey curls to leave the topping off. He didn't want to look like an unadventurous wimp in front of Shelley. Shelley ordered the key lime tart with relleno pastry, and they both ordered the fresh ground New Orleans coffee with chicory, even though something told him that chicory meant more grief for his sizzling innards. Having placed the dessert and coffee order with a firm voice and manly resolve, he put his forearms on the edge of the table,
and leaned forward and poured his eyes back into Shelley's to give her a refill of crime intoxication, as well as the last of the bottle of Crockett Sump White Zinfandel wine that was setting him back $12. That was the next-to-cheapest wine on the wine list. He didn't have the courage to order the cheapest, which was a Chablis for $9.50. Only inexperienced wet smacks ordered Chablis.
"I wish I could take you along and just have you listen to this fellow, this Roland Auburn. I've interviewed him 3 times now. At first he seems so tough, so hard, so, you know, menacing. He's a rock, with these dead eyes, the kind of teenager that's in everybody's nightmare about a dark street in New York. But if you just listen to him for 5 minutes, just listen, you start to hear something else. You hear pain. He's a boy, for God's sake. He's frightened. These boys grow up in the ghetto without anybody ever caring about them, really. They're terrified. They erect this wall of machismo, thinking it's going to protect them from harm, when in fact they're ready at any moment to be destroyed. That's what they expect. They're going to be destroyed. No, I'm not worried about Roland in front of a jury. What I'll do is, I'll lead him through some innocuous questions about his background for the first minute and a half or 2 minutes, and then he'll start shedding this tough guy outer skin of his without even knowing it, and they will believe him. He won't come across as a hardened criminal or a hardened anything. He'll come across as a frightened boy who's yearning for just a little bit of decency and just a little bit of beauty in his life, because that is precisely what he is. I wish I could think of some way to get the jury to see the drawings and collages he does. Shelley, he's brilliant, brilliant. Well, there's no way that's going to happen, I suppose. It's going to be tricky enough just to make sure I lead the real Roland Auburn out of his hard shell. It's going to be like getting a snail out of one of those shells that goes in a spiral. Kramer twirled his finger in a spiral and laughed at his own simile. Shelley's shiny lips smiled appreciatively. They glistened. She glistened.
"Oh, I'd love to attend the trial," she said. "When will it be?"
"We don't know yet. Me and the D.A., who happen to be very tight with one another. We won't even take it before the grand jury until next week. We could go to trial in 2 months or 6 months. It's hard to say in a case that's gotten as much publicity as this one has. When the media go crazy over something, it complicates things." He shook his head as if to say, "You just have to learn to put up with it." Shelley fairly beamed.
"Larry, when I got home and turned on the television last night and there you were, that drawing of you, I just started laughing like a child. I said, 'Larry!' I said it right out loud as if you'd just stepped into the room. I couldn't get over it."
"It kind of bowled me over, too, to tell you the truth."
"I'd give anything to come to the trial. Could I?"
"Sure."
"I promise I won't do anything silly."
Kramer felt a tingle. He knew this was the moment. He moved his hands forward and slid the tips of his fingers under the tips of hers without looking at them. She didn't look down either, and she didn't pull back. She kept looking into his eyes and pressed the tips of his fingers with hers.
"I don't care if you do something silly," he said.
His voice surprised him. It was so hoarse and bashful. Outside, with practically all his cash left behind in the colorfully antiquated non-electric cash register of the Café Alexandria, he took her hand and entwined his thick, pumping iron fingers among her slender, tender fingers, and they began walking along in the decrepit darkness of Beach Street.
"You know, Shelley, you can't imagine what it means to me to have you to talk to about all this. The fellas in my office, you try to get down to the heart of anything with them, and they think you're turning soft. And God help you if you turn soft. And my wife, I don't know, she just doesn't want to hear it anymore, no matter what. By now she just thinks she's married to this guy who has this grim task to perform, sending a lot of pathetic people off to jail. But this case is not pathetic. You know what this case is? It's a signal.
A very important signal to the people of this city who think they're not part of the social contract, you know? It's about a man who thinks that his exalted station in life relieves him of the obligation to treat the life of someone at the bottom of the scale the way he would treat somebody like himself. I don't doubt for a minute that if he had run down anybody even remotely like himself, McCoy would have done the right thing. He's probably what we all know of as a decent sort. That's what makes it fascinating. He's not an evil person at all, but he did an evil thing. Do you follow me?
I guess. The only thing I don't understand is why Henry Lamb didn't say anything about being hit by a car when he went to the hospital. And now that you've told me about your witness, Roland, there hasn't been anything in the papers about him, has there?
No, and we won't release anything about him for a while. What I've told you is just between us.
Well, anyway, now it turns out Roland didn't say anything about his friend being hit by a car for almost 2 weeks after it happened. Isn't that a little odd?
What's odd about it? My God, Shelley, Lamb was suffering from a fatal head injury, or it's probably fatal, and Roland knew he'd be arrested for a major felony if he talked to the cops. I wouldn't call it odd. Miss Shelley Thomas decided to back out of that avenue.
Odd isn't what I really meant. I guess I meant... I don't envy you the kind of preparation and research you must have to do to get ready for one of these cases.
Ha! If I got paid overtime for all the hours I'm going to have to put into this one, well, I could move to Park Avenue myself. But you know what? That doesn't matter to me. It really doesn't. All I care about is, whatever kind of life I lead, I want to be able to look back and say, I made a difference. This case is so important, on every conceivable level, not just in terms of my career. It's just a, I don't know how to say it, a whole new chapter. I want to make a difference, Shelley. He stopped and, still holding her hand, put it behind her waist and then pulled her to him. She was looking up at him radiantly. Their lips met. He peeked just once to see if she was keeping her eyes closed. She was. Kramer could feel her lower abdomen pressed against his. Was that the knob of her Mons Veneris? It had come along this far, this fast, so sweetly, so beautifully, and damn, no place to take her. Imagine him. The budding star of the McCoy case, and no place, no place at all in the very Babylon of the 20th century to take a lovely, willing girl with brown lipstick. He wondered what was going through her mind at this moment. In fact, she was thinking about the way men are in New York. Every time you go out with one, you have to sit there and listen to 2 or 3 hours of My Career first. It was a triumphant Peter Fallow who entered Lester's that evening, everyone at the table, and scores more among those who packed that noisy bistro, even those who turned up their noses at the city light, knew that it was he who had broken the McCoy case. Even St. John and Billy, who were seldom serious about anything other than one another's infidelities, offered congratulations with apparent sincerity. Samson Wright, the London Daily Courier's political correspondent, who was out here for a few days, happened by the table and told of his lunch with Irwin Gubner, deputy managing editor of the New York Times, who lamented that the City Light had the story practically to itself, which of course meant Peter Fallow, keeper and tender. Alex Britwithers sent over a vodka Southside on the house, and it tasted so good Fallow ordered another. The tidal wave of approval was so great that Caroline smiled the first smile he'd had from her in a very long time. The only sour note was Nick stopping. His approval was decidedly soft-spoken and half-hearted. Then Fallow realized that Nick, the Marxist-Leninist, the Oxford Spartacist, the Rousseau of the Third World, was no doubt consumed with jealousy. This was his sort of story, not this shallow comedian Fallow's. Fallow could now regard Nick's opinion of him with magnanimous amusement. And yet here was Fallow at the forefront, riding the freight train of history, while he, stopping, was writing yet another piece for House and Garden on the latest Mrs. Posh's villa in Hobe Sound, or wherever. Well, speaking of Posh, Rachel Lampwick did twit him quite a bit about using that word so much.
"Peter, I do think you might be a bit more gallant," she pronounced it the French way, "toward this Mrs. McCoy, don't you? I mean, you do go on about the posh Mr. McCoy and his posh auto and his posh flat and his posh job and his posh daddy and his posh girlfriend, or what did you call her? Foxy? I rather like that. And poor Mrs. McCoy is just his 40-year-old wife, which of course means very plain, doesn't it? Not very gallant, Peter."
But obviously Rachel had been devouring every word he wrote. So he felt nothing but a victor's warmth toward her and one and all. "The city life doesn't consider wives glamorous unless they're unfaithful," said Fallow. "We save our enthusiasm for other women." Then everyone began to speculate about the foxy brunette, and Billy Cortez, casting an eye toward St. John, said he had heard of men taking their little tarts to out-of-the-way places to avoid detection, but really, the Bronx indicated rather advanced paranoia, and Fallow ordered another vodka Southside. The hubbub was warm and happy in English, and the orange and ochre glows of Lester's were mellow and English, and Caroline was staring at him quite a lot, sometimes smiling, sometimes looking at him with a smirk, and it did make him curious. And he had another vodka Southside, and Caroline got up from her place and walked around the table to where he was and leaned over and said into his ear, "Come upstairs with me a minute." Could it be? It was so very unlikely, but could it be? They went up the spiral staircase in the back to Britt Withers's office, and Caroline, suddenly looking serious, said, "Peter, I probably shouldn't tell you what I'm going to tell you. You really don't deserve it. You haven't been very nice to me."
"Me?" said Fallow with a jolly laugh. "Caroline, you tried to spread my snout all over New York."
"What? Your snout?"
Caroline smiled through a blush.
"Well, not all over New York. In any event, after the gift I'm about to give you, I think we can call it even."
"The gift?"
"I think it's a gift. I know who your foxy brunette is. I know who was in the car with McCoy."
"You're joking."
"I'm not joking."
"All right. Who?"
"Her name is Maria Ruskin. You met her that night at the Limelight."
"I did?"
"Peter, you get so drunk. She's the wife of a man named Arthur Ruskin, who's about three times her age. He's a Jewish something rather, very rich."
"How'd you know this?"
"Do you remember my friend the artist? The Italian? Filippo? Filippo Cirazzi?"
"Ah, yes. Couldn't very well forget him, could I?"
"Well, he knows her."
"How does he know her?"
"The same way a lot of men know her. She's a slut."
"And she told him?"
"Yes."
"And he told you?"
"Yes."
"My God, Caroline, where can I find him?"
"I don't know. I can't find him myself, the little bastard."
Chapter 25. We the Jury.
"This is nothing but the establishment looking after its own," said Reverend Bacon.
He was leaning back in his chair at his desk and talking into the telephone, but his tones were official, for he was talking to the press.
"This is the power structure manufacturing and disseminating its lies with the willing connivance of its lackeys in the media, and its lies are transparent."
Edgar Fisk III, although a young man, recognized the rhetoric of the movement of the late 1960s and early 1970s. Reverend Bacon stared at the mouthpiece of the telephone with a look of righteous anger. Fisk slumped down a little farther in his chair. His eyes jumped from Reverend Bacon's face to the swamp yellow sycamores in the yard beyond the window, and then back to Reverend Bacon, and then back to the sycamores. He didn't know whether eye contact with the man was wise at this point or not, even though the thing that had provoked the anger had nothing to do with Fisk's visit. Bacon was furious over the piece in this morning's Daily News, suggesting that Sherman McCoy might have been escaping from a robbery attempt when his car hit Henry Lamb. The Daily News intimated that Lamb's accomplice was a convicted felon named Roland Auburn, and that the district attorney's entire case against Sherman McCoy was based on a story concocted by this individual, who was now seeking a plea bargain in a drug case.
"You doubt that they stoop so low?" Reverend Bacon declaimed into the mouthpiece. "You doubt they can be vile? Now you see them stoop so low. They try to smear young Henry Lamb. Now you see them vilify the victim, who lies mortally wounded and cannot speak for himself. For them to say that Henry Lamb is a robber, that's the criminal act, see? That's the criminal act. But that is the twisted mind of the power structure. That is the underlying racist mentality. Since Henry Lamb is a young black male, they think they can brand him as a criminal, see? They think they can smear him in that way. But they are wrong. Henry Lamb's life refutes their lies. Henry Lamb is everything the power structure tells the young black male he is supposed to be. But when the needs of one of their own demand it, see, one of their own, then they think nothing of turning around and trying to destroy the good name of this young man. What? Say, who are they? You think Sherman McCoy stands alone? You think he is by himself? He is one of the most powerful men at Pearson Pierce, and Pearson Pierce is one of the most powerful forces in Wall Street. I know Pearson Pierce, see? I know what they can do. You heard of capitalists? You heard of plutocrats? You take a look at Sherman McCoy, and you're looking at a capitalist. You're looking at a plutocrat. Reverend Bacon eviscerated the offending newspaper article. The Daily News was a notorious toady of the corporate interests. The reporter who wrote the pack of lies, Neil Flanagan, was a lackey so shameless as to lend his name to such a disgusting campaign. His font of so-called information, referred to coyly as sources close to the case, was obviously McCoy and his cabal. The McCoy case was of no interest to Fisk, except as ordinary gossip, although he did know the Englishman who had first exposed the whole situation, a wonderful witty fellow named Peter Fallow, who was a master of the art of conversation. No, Fisk's only interest was in how much Bacon's involvement in it was going to complicate his task, which was to retrieve the $350,000, or some part of it. In the half-hour he had been sitting here, Bacon's secretary had buzzed in with calls from two newspapers, the Associated Press, a Bronx assemblyman, a Bronx congressman, and the executive secretary of the Gay Fist Strike Force, all concerning the McCoy case. And Reverend Bacon was now talking to a man named Irv Stone from Channel One. At first, Fisk figured his mission was, yet once again, hopeless. But behind Reverend Bacon's baleful orotundity, he began to detect a buoyancy, a joie de combat. Reverend Bacon loved what was going on. He was leading the crusade. He was in his element. Somewhere in all of this, at last, if he picked the right moment, Edward Fisk III might find an opening through which to retrieve the Episcopal Church's $350,000 from the Heavenly Crusader's promiscuous heap of schemes. Reverend Bacon was saying, "There's the cause, and there's the effect, Irv. See? And we had a demonstration at the Pope Projects, where Henry Lamb lives. That's the effect, see? What happened to Henry Lamb is the effect. Well, today we're going to take it to the cause. We're going to take it to Park Avenue. To Park Avenue, see, from whence the lies commence, from whence they commence. What? Right. Henry Lamb cannot speak for himself, but he's going to have a mighty voice. He's going to have the voice of his people, and that voice is going to be heard on Park Avenue."
Fisk had never seen Reverend Bacon's face so animated. He began asking Irv Stone technical questions. Naturally, he couldn't guarantee Channel One an exclusive this time, but could he count on live coverage? What was the optimal time? Same as before? And so forth and so on. Finally, he hung up. He turned toward Fisk and looked at him with portentous concentration and said,
"The steam."
"The steam?"
"The steam. You remember I told you about the steam?"
"Oh, yes, I do."
"Well, now you're gonna see the steam coming to a head. The whole city's gonna see it, right on Park Avenue. People think the fire has gone out. They think the rage is a thing of the past. They don't know it's only been bottled up. It's when the steam is trapped, you find out what it can do. See? That's when you find out it's Powder Valley for you and your whole gang. Pierce and Pierce only know how to handle one kind of capital. They don't understand the steam. They can't handle the steam."
Fisk spotted a tiny opening. "As a matter of fact, Reverend Bacon, I was talking to a man from Pierce and Pierce about you just the other day. Linwood Talley from the Underwriting Division."
"They know me there," said Reverend Bacon.
He smiled, but a trifle sardonically.
"They know me. They don't know the steam."
"Mr. Talley was telling me about Urban Guarantee Investments. He said it's been highly successful."
"I can't complain."
"Mr. Talley didn't go into any details, but I gather it's been," he searched for the proper euphemism, "profitable right from the beginning." Reverend Bacon didn't seem inclined to expand. Fisk said nothing and tried to hold Reverend Bacon's gaze with his own in hopes of creating a conversational vacuum the great crusader couldn't resist. The truth about Urban Guarantee Investments, as Fisk had in fact learned from Linwood Talley, was that the federal government had recently given the firm $250,000 as a minority underwriter for a $7 billion issue of federally backed municipal bonds. The so-called set-aside law required that there be minority participation in the selling of such bonds, and Urban Guarantee Investments had been created to help satisfy that requirement of the law. There was no requirement that the minority firm actually sell any of the bonds, or even receive them. The lawmakers did not want to wrap the task in red tape. It was only necessary for the firm to participate in the issue. Participate was broadly defined. In most cases, Urban Guarantee Investments was but one of many such firms across the country, participation meant receiving a check for the fee from the federal government and depositing it, and not much more. Urban Guarantee Investments had no employees and no equipment, just an address, Fisk was at it, a telephone number, and a president, Reginald Bacon. "So, it just occurred to me, Reverend Bacon, in terms of our conversations and what the diocese is naturally concerned about, and what remains to be worked out, if we are to resolve what I'm sure you want to resolve just as much as the bishop, who, I have to tell you, has been pressing me on this point." Fisk paused. As often happened in his talks with Reverend Bacon, he couldn't remember how he had begun his sentence. He had no idea what the number and tense of the predicate should be. "Pressing me on this point, and, the thing is, we thought perhaps you might be in a position to shift some funds into the escrow account we mentioned, the escrow account for the Little Shepherd Daycare Center, just until our licensing problems are worked out."
"I don't follow you," said Reverend Bacon.
Fisk had the sinking feeling he was going to have to think of some way to say it again, but Reverend Bacon bailed him out.
"Are you saying we ought to shift money from Urban Guarantee Investments to the Little Shepherd Daycare Center?"
"Not in so many words, Reverend Bacon, but if the funds are available or could be loaned out..."
"But that's illegal. You're talking about commingling funds. We can't shift monies from one corporation to another just because it looks like one of them needs it more."
Fisk looked at the rock of fiscal probity, half expecting a wink, even though he knew Reverend Bacon wasn't a winker. "Well, the diocese has always been willing to go the extra mile with you, Reverend Bacon, in the sense that if there was room to find some flexibility in the strict reading of the regulation, such as the time you and the board of directors of the Inner City Family Restructuring Society made the trip to Paris, and the diocese paid for it out of the Missionary Society budget." Once again, he was drowning in the syntactical soup, but it didn't matter.
"No way," said Reverend Bacon.
"Well, if not that, then..." Reverend Bacon's secretary's voice came over the intercom. "Mr. Vogel is on the line." Reverend Bacon wheeled about to the telephone on the credenza.
"Al? Yeah, I saw it. They'll drag that young man's name through the mud and think nothing of it."
Reverend Bacon and his caller Vogel went on for some time about the piece in the Daily News. This Mr. Vogel evidently reminded Reverend Bacon that the district attorney, Weiss, had told the Daily News there was absolutely no evidence to support the theory of a robbery attempt.
"Can't depend on him," said Reverend Bacon. "He's like the bat. You know the fable of the bat? The birds and the beasts were having a war. As long as the birds were winning, the bat says he's a bird, because he can fly. When the beasts were winning, the bat says he's a beast, because he got teeth. That's why the bat don't come out in the daytime. Don't nobody want to look at his two faces."
Reverend Bacon listened for a bit, then said,
"Yes, I do, Al. There's a gentleman from the Episcopal Diocese of New York with me right now. You want me to call you back?" "Uh-huh. Uh-huh. You say his apartment's worth $3 million? He shook his head. "I never heard of such a thing. I say it's time Park Avenue heard the voice of the streets." "Uh-huh. I'll call you back about that. I'll talk to Annie Lamb before I call you. When you thinking about filing?" "About the same when I talked to her yesterday. He's on the life support system. He don't say anything and don't know anybody. When you think about that young man, there's no amount can pay for it, is there? Well, I'll get back to you as soon as I can."
After he hung up, Reverend Bacon shook his head sadly, but then looked up with a gleam in his eye and just a trace of a smile. With an athletic quickness, he rose from his chair and came around the desk with his hand out, as if Fisk had just announced he had to leave.
"Always good to see you."
Reflexively, Fisk shook his hand, at the same time saying, "But, Reverend Bacon, we haven't—"
"We'll talk again. I got an awful lot to do. A demonstration right on Park Avenue. Gotta help Mr. Lamb file a $100 million lawsuit against Sherman McCoy."
"But, Reverend Bacon, I can't leave without an answer. The diocese has really reached the end. That is, they insist that I—"
"You tell the diocese. They're doing fine. I told you last time this is the best investment you people ever made. You tell them they're taking an option. They're buying the future at a discount. You tell them they'll see what I mean very shortly. No time at all."
He put his arm around Fisk's shoulder in a comradely fashion and hastened his exit, all the while saying,
"Don't worry about a thing. You're doing fine, see? Doing fine. They're gonna say, 'That young man, he took a risk and hit the jackpot.'"
Utterly befuddled, Fisk was swept outside by a tide of optimism and the pressure of a strong arm across his back. The noise of the bullhorn and the bellows of rage rose up 10 stories from Park Avenue in the heat of June. 10 stories, nothing to it. They can almost reach up. Until the bedlam below seemed to be part of the air he breathed. The bullhorn bellowed his name. The hard sea and McCoy cut through the roar of the mob and soared up above the vast sprawl of hatred below. He edged over to the library window and risked looking down. Suppose they see me. The demonstrators had spilled out onto the street on both sides of the median strip and had brought traffic to a halt. The police were trying to drive them back onto the sidewalks. 3 policemen were chasing another bunch, 15 or 20 at least, through the yellow tulips on the median strip. As they ran, the demonstrators held a long banner aloft. "Wake up, Park Avenue! You can't hide from the people!" The yellow tulips fell before them, and they left a gutter of crushed blossoms behind them, and the 3 policemen came pounding through the gutter. Sherman stared, horrified. The sight of the perfect yellow spring tulips of Park Avenue falling before the feet of the mob paralyzed him with fear. A television crew lumbered along out in the street trying to catch up with them. The one carrying the camera on his shoulder stumbled, and down he went, crashing to the pavement, camera and all. The mob's banners and placards bobbed and swayed like sails in a windy harbor. One enormous banner said inexplicably, "Gay fist against class justice." The 2 S's in class were swastikas. Another one, "Christ," Sherman caught his breath. In gigantic letters it said, "Sherman McCoy, we the jury want you." Then there was a crude approximation of a finger pointing straight at you, as in the old Uncle Sam Wants You posters.
They seemed to be holding it at an angle just so he could read it from up here. He fled the library and sat in the rear part of the living room in an armchair, one of Judy's beloved Louis-something Bergères. Or was it a fauteuil? Killian was pacing up and down, still crowing about the article in the Daily News, apparently to buck up his spirits. But Sherman was no longer listening. He could hear the deep, ugly voice of one of the bodyguards who was in the library answering the telephone.
"Stick it up your face!"
Every time one of the threats came in over the telephone, the bodyguard, a small, swarthy man named Occhioni, said,
"Stick it up your face!"
The way he said it, it sounded worse than any of the classic vulgarities. How had they gotten his private number? Probably from the press, in the open cavity. They were here on Park Avenue, at the door below. They were coming in over the telephone. How long before they burst in, into the entry gallery, and came screaming across that solemn green marble floor? The other bodyguard, McCarthy, was in the entry gallery sitting in one of Judy's beloved Thomas Hope armchairs, and what good would he be? Sherman sat back, his eyes cast downward, fixed upon the slender legs of a Sheraton Pembroke table, a hellishly expensive thing Judy had found in one of those antique shops on 57th Street. Hellishly expensive. Hellishly. Mr. Occhioni, who said,
"Stick it up your face,"
to everyone who called, threatening his life, $200 per eight-hour shift. Another $200 for the impassive Mr. McCarthy. Doubled that for the two bodyguards at his parents' house on East 73rd, where Judy, Campbell, Bonita, and Miss Lyons were. $800 per eight-hour shift. All former New York City policemen from some agency Killian knew about. $2,400 a day. Hemorrhaging money.
"McCoy! McCoy!"
A tremendous roar from the street below. And presently, he wasn't thinking about the Pembroke table or the bodyguards anymore. He was staring catatonically and wondering about the barrel. How big was it? He had used it so many times, most recently on the Leash Club hunt last fall. But he couldn't remember how big it was. It was big, being a double-barrel 12-gauge. Was it too big to get in his mouth? No, it couldn't be that big. But what would it feel like? What would it feel like, touching the roof of his mouth? What would it taste like? Would he have trouble breathing long enough to... How would he pull the trigger? Let's see. He'd hold the barrel steady in his mouth with one hand, his left hand. But how long was the barrel? It was long. Could he reach the trigger with his right hand? Maybe not. His toe. He'd read somewhere about someone who took off his shoe and pressed the trigger with his toe. Where would he do it? The gun was at the house on Long Island. Assuming he could get to Long Island, get out of this building, escape from besieged Park Avenue, get away alive from we, the jury, the flower bed out beyond the tool house. Judy always called it the cutting bed. He'd sit down out there. If it made a mess, it wouldn't matter. Suppose Campbell was the one who found him. The thought didn't reduce him to tears the way he thought it might, hoped it might. She wouldn't be finding her father. He wasn't her father anymore. Wasn't anything anyone had ever known as Sherman McCoy. He was only a cavity, fast filling with hot, vile hate. The telephone rang in the library. Sherman braced,
"Stick it up your face."
But all he heard was the rumble of Occhioni's normal voice. Presently, the little man stuck his head into the living room and said,
"Hey, Mr. McCoy, it's somebody named Sally Rothroat. You want to talk to her or not?"
Sally Rothroat? She was the woman he had sat next to at the Bavardages, the woman who had lost interest in him immediately and then froze him out for the rest of the dinner. Why would she want to talk to him now? Why would he want to talk to her at all? He didn't, but a tiny spark of curiosity was lit within the cavity. and he stood up and looked at Killian and shrugged and went into the library and sat at his desk and picked up the telephone. Hello?
Sherman? Sally Rothroat.
Sherman, oldest friend in the world.
I hope this isn't a bad time.
A bad time? From below, a tremendous roar welled up, and the bullhorn screamed and bellowed, and he heard his name, McCoy! McCoy!
Well, of course it's a bad time, said Sally Rothroat. What am I saying? But I just thought I'd take a chance and call and see if there's any way I might help.
Help? As she spoke, her face came back to him. That dreadful, tense, nearsighted face that focused about 4.5 inches from the bridge of your nose. Well, thank you, said Sherman.
You know, I live just a few blocks down from you, same side of the street.
Oh, yes.
I'm on the northwest corner. If you're going to live on Park, I think there's nothing quite like the northwest corner. You get so much sun. Of course, where you are is nice, too. Your building's got some of the most beautiful apartments in New York. I haven't been in yours since the McLeods had it. They had it before the Kittredges. Anyway, from my bedroom, which is on the corner, I can look right down Park to where you are. I'm looking down there right now, and that mob, it's absolutely outrageous. I feel so badly for you and Judy. I just had to call and see if there's anything I can do. I hope I'm not being out of place.
No, you're very kind. By the way, how did you get my number?
I called Inez Bavardage. Was that all right?
To tell you the truth, it doesn't make a hell of a lot of difference at this point, Mrs. Rothroat.
Sally.
Anyway, thank you.
As I say, if I can be of any help, let me know. With the apartment, is what I mean.
With the apartment? Another rumble. A roar.
McCoy! McCoy!
If you should decide you want to do anything with the apartment. I'm with Benning Sturdivant, as you probably know, and I know that often in situations like this people sometimes find it advantageous to become as liquid as they can. Ha ha! I could stand a bit of that myself. Anyway, it's a consideration, and I assure you, I can get you 3.5 for your apartment. Just like that, I can guarantee it.
The woman's gall was astounding. It was beyond good and bad form, beyond taste. It was astounding. It made Sherman smile, and he didn't think he could smile. Well, 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 Sally, I do admire foresightedness. You looked out your northwest window and you saw an apartment for sale.
Not at all. I just thought,
well, you're just one step too late, Sally. You'll have to talk to a man named Albert Vogel.
Who's that?
He's the lawyer for Henry Lamb. He's filed $100 million lawsuit against me, and I'm not sure if I'm free to sell a rug at this point. Well, maybe I could sell a rug. You want to sell a rug for me?
Ha ha, no. Rugs I don't know anything about. I don't see how they can freeze your assets. That seems totally unfair. I mean, you were the victim, after all, weren't you? I read the story in the Daily News today. Ordinarily, I only read Bess Hill and Bill Hatcher, but I was turning the pages, and there was your picture. I said, my God, it's Sherman. So I read the story, and you were only avoiding a robbery attempt. It's so unfair, she chattered on.
She was fireproof. She couldn't be mocked. After hanging up, Sherman returned to the living room. Killian said,
who is that?
Sherman said, a real estate broker I met at dinner. She wanted to sell my apartment for me.
She say how much she could get you?
$3.5 million.
Well, let's see, said Killian. If she gets her 6% commission, that's, $210,000. That's worth sounding stone-cold opportunistic over, I guess. But I'll say one thing for her.
What's that?
She made you smile, so she ain't all bad.
Another roar, the loudest yet.
McCoy! McCoy!
The two of them stood in the middle of the living room and listened for a moment. Jesus, Tommy, said Sherman.
It was the first time he had called him by his first name, but he didn't stop to think about that. I can't believe I'm standing here and all this is happening. I'm holed up in my apartment and Park Avenue is occupied by a mob waiting to kill me. Kill me? Aw, for Christ's sake, that's the last thing they want to do. You ain't worth a goddamn thing to Bacon dead, and he thinks you're going to be worth a lot to him alive. To Bacon? What does he get out of it? Millions is what he thinks he's going to get out of it. I can't prove it, but I say this whole thing is over to civil suits. But Henry Lamb is the one who's suing, or his mother, I guess it is, and